Oh, welcome to Left Out on WRCT 88.3 FM in Pittsburgh. Left Out presents news and opinions from a perspective left out of the mainstream media. I'm Bob Harper.
I'm Danny Slater.
Today's program is produced for us by Molly Meyer. Listeners are welcome to call us at 412-621-9728 or 89728 on campus. And we also monitor electronic mail. If you can send mail to bob@leftout.info if you wish. And listeners are invited to call. One announcement to make I wanted to mention was that Democracy Now! On WRCT, many of our listeners also listen to Democracy Now!, listeners will be happy to know that it's on live, 8 a.m. Monday through Friday. Many of you know that until recently, for technical reasons, we were running it one day late, and now it's running live every morning at 8 o'clock. Yay.
Yeah,
and
great news.
And some days of the week, it's running again at 9. Is that right?
Right.
Thursday and Fridays, it's repeated at 9.
At 8 and 9, right.
At 9 o'clock. Okay. So that's really great news, and so I hope all of you will listen to Democracy Now! It's a great program and a nice alternative to the stuff we usually get about the news and the U.S. So later on in the program, we're going to have a guest, Dr. John White, who is a former Deputy Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration. We'll come back to him a little bit later. But before we get to that, we'll start out with a few other news items. One amusing item that came up this week was that it seems that George Bush is under a lot of stress worrying about the election and about the disintegration of the situation, a bungled foreign policy in the Middle East, right, exactly. And it seems that things have gotten so bad with Bush that he's actually resorted to telling the truth. Now, I know that will come as a surprise to you, because it really would be quite a rarity that he would be telling the truth. But actually, he really is, and I'll even quote it. This is one of the rare occasions in which I can say that here's a quotation from Bush that seems really precisely accurate. So he gave a speech last week. I have an article here dated August the 5th, in which he was talking about his wondrous record as the war president, and how tough he is in fighting terrorism and so on, as usual. And one of the comments that he made, he was emphasizing all of his accomplishments, and one of the accomplishments that he was especially proud of is this, as he says, and I quote, "Our enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we." And that's a quote from George W. Bush, who, in a moment of lucidity, was actually saying exactly what seems to be the case for the last 4 years. So maybe there's hope for him yet. Who knows? But I can certainly say that the White House immediately afterward was hastening to explain that he's a busy man and doesn't always know what he's talking about. And
did they respond to that?
They responded to it, and I suppose that's also true, that he doesn't always know what he's talking about. In fact, he almost never knows what he's talking about. But anyway, it's just an amusing Bushism. And the thing that's kind of remarkable, we were talking about it before the program today, was that it's not as though we're making fun of him because he has a stutter or he speaks with a lisp or something that can't be helped, and it would just be unkind and irrelevant to his role as president. The thing to emphasize here, I mean, what we're really talking about is a perfectly lucid, perfectly grammatical, perfectly clearly stated bunch of baloney, and he seems to show no recognition when he's saying a sentence like that. He doesn't seem to have even the glimmer of a recognition that he's speaking rubbish, and it's amazing that he seems to have so little self-awareness, not to mention awareness of the world at large. Well, anyway, so that's an amusing thing. So you'll be comforted to know that President Bush will
is acknowledging his own accomplishments.
The real agenda of the Bush administration. And now, so the other thing is that comes up, it's kind of tangentially related, and it's actually an article that both of these articles, the first point we mentioned was widely reported, But the second I've seen is on a website called Capitol Hill Blue, which you're welcome to look at, and you can reach your own judgments as to what you think about this website. But they're organized. Their mission is to kind of report on goings on inside the Beltway, and not everything that they say is widely reported in the mainstream news media. And you can make of that whatever you like. One of the things that they have been reporting, and this is not the first time I've seen this, certainly about a month ago or so, I can't remember, but let's say earlier this summer, they were reporting, they've made a similar report, but now they're actually following up on this, which is reporting on Bush's alleged erratic behavior inside the Capitol, or inside the White House. And, you know, this is serious. If it's even slightly correct, this is very serious, because the suggestion here from the article is that Bush is behaving very erratically, and in fact, some people compare it to Nixon's behavior in the closing days of his presidency, when
pacing the halls, talking to the portraits of other presidents.
Right, Nixon was often described as talking to the portraits of the other presidents, and also being rather drunk in the White House, because he was drowning his sorrows, which were at the later stages of his presidency were considerable, since a lot of things were catching up with him. A lot of chickens were coming to roost all at once, and that's even after the fact. Well, after the fact is acknowledged. I don't think anyone particularly disputes this. So, but what is not acknowledged, and which is not wholly clear that this is true, but there are these stories coming out that that Bush is similarly behaving strangely inside the White House, and now they're reporting. Go ahead.
Well, the article described an incident in which he, after being refusing to answer questions, reporters' questions in a press conference about his relationship to Kenneth Lay, he walked out of the press conference and stormed in back of the room and saying, "Keep those expletive deleted away from me," he screamed to an aide backstage. "If you can't, I'll find someone who can." And they go on to talk the worry about his mental stability in the article. And also, the main point of the article is that he's apparently on antidepressants, a powerful antidepressant drugs to keep him sane. But the danger there, of course, is that if you take too many of these, lots of bad things can happen. So there's just a general worry that the guy's unstable, and they don't really know how to deal with that. That's kind of the thrust of the article.
All right. Well, that's enough on this topic. I think we have our guest for today. Danny, would you like to introduce him?
Yes. We're hoping that we have John P. White on the phone. John, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Hello. I'm Danny Slater, and my colleague is Bob Harper. Bob Harper, we're having a live call-in program right now, and you're our caller right now. We won't be taking other callers during when you're on the line. So. So you're a lecturer in public policy at the Kennedy School right now, and you had served under Clinton as the Deputy Secretary of Defense from 1995 to 1997.
Correct.
Yeah. I looked around the web for some of your previous writings and stuff. You were editor of a book on foreign policy. You've done lots of work on missile defense. But I didn't find your most recent interest or the speeches you've been giving recently or the topics you've. But I suppose it has to do with terrorism and the terrorism alerts and the homeland security issues.
Well, it has to do with that and also with the issues around the issues facing the Department of Defense, particularly with respect to the manpower issues, which is an area that I've always spent a lot of time on, going way back to when I was an analyst at the RAND Corporation, 35 years ago,
mm-hmm.
Because I'm concerned that we are really jeopardizing the value of the most magnificent military that's ever been created.
By overextending?
By overextending, yes, and mm-hmm. mismanaging, yes.
And so what is your analysis of that? What is the cause and what is the solution?
Well, the cause is that, I think, first of all, we made a terrible mistake by underestimating the requirements we had in Iraq, and then persisting in our view, and the administration view that it needed no more troops in Iraq when it became manifestly true that it did,
mm-hmm.
and therefore not making any long-term adjustments, because these adjustments inevitably have to be longer term in terms of growing the size of the force and better managing the force. And as a result of that, of course, we have real morale issues and effectiveness issues, because we're turning people around and sending them back before they've had the requisite time to retrain, refit, and also spend time with their family.
Right. Yeah, so I think it's been widely reported that the Guard and Reserve are heavily overextended. I've even heard it's one of these little anecdotes, but I've even heard that the Honor Guard at the Tomb of the Unknowns in Washington was activated for the Gulf War.
And what would happen if we had another contingency?
Yeah, so that's
we built this force for significant contingencies, and now we've been running it down.
Now, no doubt, having worked in the Pentagon, you must know Eric Shinseki, who has retired.
Very well, yes.
So he was certainly calling attention to this before we went into Iraq.
Well, absolutely, and he what he was doing, of course, was sizing our experience, because we've had about seven of these in the last 15 years, and so we know a lot about what has been our experience in the past. And when you took places like Bosnia and Kosovo and then just sort of refactored them for the size and complexity of Iraq, it came to a very big number.
But
it could easily come to 300,000 troops.
Yeah, but I guess I you know, what question that comes to my mind is well, I mean, clearly there were a lot of terrible mistakes made at the beginning of the Iraq War, and well, seems to be continual mistakes with the way they're handling things there. But if they had, you know, more troops, would that have dealt with the bad judgment? That seems like only one problem. I mean,
well, I think it is only one problem.
I mean, if
the
try to install Chalabi, now you install this new guy, Alawi, who's apparently a crook and a thug as well, and then you tell them you have to turn off Al Jazeera, you can't have a forgiveness plan for the people who are killing Americans. It's just every step of the way. That, I mean, if you have more troops there, I don't know how that would really, that wouldn't solve the
No, I wasn't suggesting that was the single problem. I was just, you know, you asked about my own particular professional
focus. I see.
In terms of these issues, and that's one of them.
Okay, yeah. So that does bring up the question. I mean, I think John Kerry recently, within the last week roughly, has said, I think he wants to increase the size of the military by something like 40,000 troops.
About 40,000.
Is that right?
Yeah. He's been saying that now for a couple of months.
Okay, so how is that going to work? I mean, where are they going to come from?
Well, what you would have to do is, first of all, improve your retention, which I think is still feasible in the active force, and secondly, you would have to increase your accessions, the number of young men and women you take into the force.
And
we can do that. That is to say, if we look back on our history over the 30 years of the all-volunteer force, we've had substantially higher demands than we have today. So that's not inexpensive, but it's not infeasible at all.
I guess I'm just wondering that if we're at the point now where the reserves are already taxed to, well, beyond their limits, I think many would say, how do you scrape the barrel any deeper? I mean, where do these 40,000 people come from, and where do you find the officers to command them and manage them and so forth?
I mean, you're already, recruiting up several hundred thousand a year, every year,
mm-hmm.
and you increase that number. You're going to have to build new units. You're going to have to equip new units. It's going to take quite some time. It'll take several years.
I see.
But
so
that's just the nature of the size and complexity of the problem.
So what incentive? I mean, so do you think that just the normal course of recruitment is sufficient? We're still recruiting enough people even in the wake of the Iraq War?
Oh, yes, we are now recruiting enough.
Oh, even in the wake of the war?
Yes.
Oh, I see.
We're generally making our numbers.
I see.
Not only in quantity, but more importantly in quality.
I see. So then does it require any change? I mean, do we just continue as we're proceed apace?
It requires obviously more emphasis and more money and a commitment to a larger force, which the administration is resisting.
which they're certainly strongly against.
Right.
Well, one way in which they want to effectively enlarge the force, if you, in a manner of speaking, is by employing private contractors, because that presumably frees up soldiers for other chores, and thereby kind of increases the force size. So, what do you think about that?
I mean, well, I think in terms of rear area activities and a lot of activities, it's a good idea. I think we're seeing a problem when we put them in areas such as, which look much more like specific military functions like security, that we run into all kinds of problems. Are these people properly trained? Who are they responsible to? Under what various laws do they perform their activities?
That was a big issue that came up in the Abu Ghraib scandal. Like, who these people don't seem to be under any jurisdiction or any legal structure.
They're accountable to.
Right.
So the idea, the theory in outsourcing in the Department of Defense, I spent a lot of my career in the Pentagon, and two tours in the Pentagon, first as an assistant secretary and then 20 years later as the deputy secretary, expanding the outsourcing. That means getting people to under contract who provide services to the department, so you don't have to hire a lot more people in the Defense Department. But the things that lend themselves to that are those where you have a good market in the private sector, which will address those issues, and you have real competition. So that means, you know, accounting, transportation, logistics, all kinds of mundane but very important functions. It certainly doesn't mean the bodyguard for
Bremer,
president of Iraq.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, how do you deal with issues that are just management issues? Like, how do you deal with the fact that you have a soldier who's driving a truck making, you know, X thousand dollars per month, and you have a private contractor driving the same truck on the same route who's making, you know, five or six X thousand dollars per month?
I think that's a very serious issue, and in fact, if you thought it through more, you wouldn't want to have those two side by side, would you?
Right.
You'd want to have you'd want to have a clear function for the soldier that was a military function, and a clear domestic or civilian function for the other person. And we're fusing those not only in terms of the function, but also in terms of their location, right? We're putting these people right in the line of fire.
Well, even more galling is that the private contractors can refuse to go into a dangerous situation, whereas the soldiers cannot.
They can not only refuse, but they have been refusing.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. We're talking to John White, and your calls are welcome after he hangs up. You can call in at 412-621-9728. I just switching gears a little bit,
sure,
into what your view of the solution to the, well, I'll call it a debacle in Iraq. You've mentioned needing more troops, and that was Kerry's proposal, but at this point, how do we get out of there? It looks more and more like a quagmire.
Well, I think it is not at all an easy issue, as you said, and I obviously don't have a magic wand. We are in a vicious combat situation and a chicken-egg problem where you can't make progress without security, and you can't get security unless you make some progress. So I think it will take, in fact, more U.S. troops in the short run. And I think, as John Kerry has said, you're going to have to find some way to get other people involved, as we have in other conflicts, in Afghanistan, in Kosovo, in Bosnia, and so on and so forth. That will not be easy. If you had a new president with new leadership and new appeal, that may be more feasible. It doesn't look feasible under the current administration.
I assume
you're going to have to find some way to make this a solution larger than it is.
Yeah. I assume you're a supporter of Kerry, or are you taking...
Yes, I am a supporter of Kerry.
Yeah. Well, there's some other issues I know you wrote about over the years. One of them was the missile defense systems. And personally, I'm a great skeptic of that whole project. I found a paper that you wrote in 2000 in which you... Well, you were kind of straddling the fence on it. Maybe you can describe your own position, but it was that we don't need the national missile defense right now, but we should
ought to have a more regional defense that looks at the issues more broadly than just us in the continental, you know, in protecting the continental U.S. So, today I would expand that issue. That is to say, we haven't done nearly enough on protecting ourselves against weapons of mass destruction. And we spend an enormous amount of money on the missile defense program. I mean, billions upon billions, mm-hmm. which in most scenarios looks like one of the least likely ways that we will be attacked.
Right.
It's certainly less cost-effective to conduct that kind of an operation than it is to conduct, for example, a bio operation, which is relatively simple and could be extremely devastating.
So how do you account for this imbalance of interest?
I think it grows out of the legacy of the Cold War, and this system began toward the end of the Cold War when in fact we saw that we might be able to do so. Remember, this goes really way back to Star Wars, back to Reagan.
Yeah.
Where we thought we could do so, and we saw a possible threat, and we knew how to deal with that threat, and we had not yet become adequately aware of the other impending threats, particularly the terrorist threat, the loose nukes threat, the bio threat, and so on. So we got ourselves on a track that then it's very hard to get off of, but we're spending enormous amounts of money on what strikes me now is a lower priority problem.
Yeah, I've often wondered that myself. There seems to be a contradiction there about the of emphasis.
And think about it in terms of the perpetrator. Here is a system where we will know unequivocally where it came from, right?
Right.
is that what you would like to do?
Yeah.
I mean, we still have a Cold War arsenal of these capabilities, so that looks to me pretty suicidal.
I had two other questions before you. I know you have to probably
sure.
go pretty soon, but I have a couple other questions. One was the issue of the terror alert that came out right after the Democratic Convention, when Kerry was supposed to be getting a nice lift. There seemed to be this spurious terror alert based on three-year-old data. If you could comment on that. And the other question I have before I forget it is, you said you're a supporter of Kerry. If you could just maybe take a minute to say why,
sure.
Why you are.
Let me deal with the first question. I think there's a couple of problems there that have to be worked through. The first one is, I understand the dilemma that the folks have, but what is the message when we tell the American people this is a terror alert, but don't change your behavior? There's something wrong with that. Secondly, I would fault the administration for the way this was communicated. First, we were told that it was current data, or at least it was implied it was current data. Then we were told it was old data but relevant, which is adequate, you know, an adequate explanation, but not second. And then we're told that some of it's old and some of it's new and so on and so forth. So then you increase the confusion around what people are supposed to do, and you raise questions about the integrity of your collection and distribution system. Not that people are not being honest, but in fact that it isn't a very good system. And when you put that on top of what we've had with weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and 9/11 and so on and so forth, it erodes the credibility of the whole defense.
Yeah, and I think many people begin to just disregard it, right? Because there's nothing
exactly
you can do with this information.
You're exactly right. If you tell me I'm seriously threatened, but I should continue to whistle down the street.
It doesn't make any sense.
Over and over.
If you're going to blow up the...
If you do it repeatedly to me, it doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, well, I think the telling point is that Ridge, in his announcement, if I may interject my own opinion, made a point of emphasizing that it was because of the superior diligence and capability of the president, President Bush, that they were able to uncover this and report this.
Yeah, well,
I mean that's just an advertisement that is injected
exactly.
into.
Oh, but he's non-political. He said that. He said he's totally non-political.
Anyway, I wondered if you might also offer us your thoughts about Kerry's candidacy
sure.
for president.
There are several reasons. Let me start with the defense reasons. As we've been talking, I think the administration, which is really taking a hard right turn in terms of what has been our national security direction of both parties for a long time into preemption, into the attack on Iraq, which in retrospect looks like it was A, not justified, and maybe even importantly, a bad idea, compounded by bad management. Afghanistan, for which I applaud the president, which we have then neglected because of the diversion into Iraq. We now have two really much more threatening problems, that is North Korea and Iran with nuclear weapons, and yet our capabilities are eroded, and our credibility has been debased. These are really big problems, and it seems to me you need new leadership, and I think John Kerry has displayed in himself and in his behavior and in what he's been saying from a policy point of view, someone who would bring fresh and aggressive and clear leadership in terms of these issues. The other issue that bothers me, as I'm trained as an economist, is that we are running up deficits, larger deficits notionally, nominally, than we've ever had. We're running up deficits. We've cut taxes. So effectively what we're doing is borrowing from the Chinese and other buyers of our bonds to fund our government rather than funding it ourselves, which will end up meaning we're going to get our government funded by our children when they grow up. That strikes me as very bad fiscal policy and irresponsible.
Yeah.
We don't, in a society this big and this rich, this generation ought to pay for itself. We did that. We had a huge battle about balanced budgets starting in 1993. We balanced the budget, and I would add thanks a lot to Bill Clinton, by the way, and to many others. And then we've let that go by largely, I think, on ideological grounds.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly isn't on hard economic theory.
Hear, hear. And so how do you think Kerry will be able to change these things? I mean, suppose there's still a Republican Congress, for example.
He's going to lower taxes on the, he's going to raise taxes on the rich.
He may raise taxes on the rich. He may be able to do some other things in terms of tax policy. Hopefully, he will be fiscally conservative in the sense of taking a pass on some things in terms of expenditures. I mean, the Bush administration is not conservative. How can you claim you're conservative when you're running up huge deficits and, in fact, expanding the expenditure rate of the federal government?
Here.
Yep. And on that note, I guess we should wind up this segment of the program. Thanks a lot.
I enjoyed talking to you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much for appearing on Left Out.
We've been talking to...
We'll do it again.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. So that was a conversation with John P. White. And if you want to call us, you can give us a call at 412-621-9728. We'll take a brief break, and then we'll be back.